that you have to suffer through because I knew them at some part in their career. Laura was the head of the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva when I was on the NSC staff, and we worked together on the, and she was also the special U.S. representative to the Biological Weapons Convention, and we worked together on a major review conference that was being held for the BWC at that time, and I really was impressed by her work there, but that was just a small sliver of her career. So let me introduce her. Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone here and those listening to us on the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 443rd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. The Midcoast was founded in 1983 to invite a foreign affairs expert each month to speak and answer questions on an issue critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. Audios of past forum talks, information about upcoming forum programs, and information on how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. We're very pleased to have Ambassador Laura Kennedy with us today to speak on the Central Asian states of the former Soviet Union. Central Asia is an area of the world that we hear more and more about, but few of us have any knowledge of that part of the world or its people. So it's nice to have someone who is an expert here to talk to us about it because it's a very important part of the world. Ambassador Laura Kennedy is a foreign affairs expert who served for nearly 40 years with the U.S. Foreign Service. She was ambassador to Turkmenistan from 2001 to 2003, Deputy Secretary of Defense of Deputy Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs from 2004 to 2005, and taught and served as Deputy Commandant at the National War College from 2007 to 2009. In 2010, she was appointed U.S. Permanent Representative to the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva and Special Representative for Biological Weapons Convention issues. She served in this post until 2013. After retiring, Ambassador Kennedy was recalled to active service with the Foreign Service in May of 2014 to serve as a chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Turkmenistan. And that was a time when there was no confirmed ambassador at the post, which means she actually was in charge of the embassy there once again. She then served as a chargé at the U.S. mission to the United Nations in Vienna and a member of the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency until 2015. She also, you know, served a couple of tours in Moscow, and she was in Vienna for several times. So she's been around to a lot of different parts of the world and a lot of important positions. Ambassador Kennedy is an elected member of the American Academy of Diplomacy and serves on the board of the Arms Control Association, the Advisory Council of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, and the Leadership Council for Women in National Security and Deep Cuts Commission. Laura, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Midcoast Forum.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Thank you, George, for that great introduction. I'll stand over here. And you folks were kind enough to set me up with a map so you can keep in mind where Central Asia fits in the world. But before I turn the map on, I just wanted to, one, again, thank George and Karen not only for that introduction, but for hosting me so graciously. This really is my first introduction to Maine, although my dad, who left college in World War II to join the Navy, was assigned to a destroyer, the USS Sellers. I know there's at least one Navy guy in the audience. Hit by a kamikaze, then was repaired in Norfolk, came up to Maine to patrol, and he was assigned to this destroyer, patrolling along Maine. Then it went to the inn for repairs, but my mother was with him, with her brand new infant, along with the future Chief of Naval Operations, the great Admiral Bud Zumwalt, whose wife also had a little baby. Anyhow, so here they were in Maine in the winter at Casco Bay, a wood-burning stove, and two babies, my older sister, in diapers. So that was my family's first exposure to Maine. But if nothing else, it exposed them to the hospitality and the grit of Maine. So what were two babies in diapers in the middle of winter with a wood-burning stove? They managed, thanks to all the help and support they got from their Maine neighbor. So anyhow, it's really a pleasure to be here today. And one of the things, by the way, I just want to mention is I also work with an organization called Foreign Policy for America, which believes very much that foreign policy is not just an issue for think tanks in Washington, but that diplomacy does affect all Americans in so many ways, whether it's security, whether it's selling American goods and services abroad, therefore creating employment for Americans at home, a whole range of issues. So it is such a pleasure, again, to come to a new state for me and meet so many people who are willing to devote time out of their day, and regularly with the forum, with the Camden Conference, to examining all of these issues that really do affect us every day, even though it doesn't seem like it on a day-to-day basis. I mean, what happens and how we deal with it, my belief is, really does matter. So let me turn then to today's topic, which is one slice of the world out there, Central Asia, which in general is fairly little known to the United States, although I'm delighted in my short time here and the Mainers I've met. Several have visited Central Asia. One former colleague from the State Department worked there. So I hope that you all, maybe others who haven't, might be interested in visiting it at some time, because that's another interest of mine. I've worked with both the New York Times and the Smithsonian since I've left government service to bring groups of Americans to visit these countries. So let's see. Okay, so there's the broad globe, and there's these five Central Asians. So let me start with a little bit of just context for you. And of course, when we get into Q&A, you go wherever you want. Although, again, I was a former diplomat. I'm not an anthropologist or an historian, so I'm just going to give you a bit of context for Central Asia, and then shift to U.S. policy in the area, brief history of that, and try and bring it up to today. And I'm glad to hear you say that you're going to have two speakers from Afghanistan, because, of course, this has loomed quite large in recent years in our interest in Central Asia. Okay, so Central Asia. So as George said, we're going to talk about the five former republics of the Soviet Union. Some people believe that when you talk about Central Asia, you should talk only about the broader concept. Those five republics, you should also talk about Western China, Xinjiang province, which is the home of the Muslim minority of China, which is a Turkic, ethnically Turkic, and Turkic-speaking people, the whole South Asian subcontinent. Incidentally, it was a direct descendant of the great Central Asian Khan, Tamerlane, that you may have heard about, who went south from Uzbekistan and established the Mughal Empire, the Muslim Empire in the subcontinent. Afghanistan obviously borders the three of the republics, Iran, and all of these countries bordering Central Asia do have groups of Central Asians who over the years moved across the borders, because of course over the centuries there really were no fixed borders as we know them today. Here we are about 30 years in from independence, but one of the things that I find so interesting about Central Asia is you have a set of five states that gained their independence at the same time. So it's a sort of a testing ground for forging new nations. But they're coming out of a very ancient civilization, civilizations, I should say, because one of the chief characteristics about this area is it's very syncretic. And when I say that, I mean it's a overlay over overlay over overlay of different ethnic groups, religions, histories. Sort of broadly started the area. It was sort of settled by, I don't know, I guess you'd call proto-Indo-Europeans. Now my husband, who's also a diplomat and knows far more about the history of languages and groups, can talk to you about proto-Indo-Europeans if you like. But anyhow, a whole history over the thousands of years of Persian, Turkic, Mongolian peoples, Hellenistic civilizations. Alexander the Great came through Central Asia as far as what is today modern Tajikistan and left various city-states populated by his generals. Ancient Jewish communities. If you visit Bukhara in Uzbekistan, you still have that ancient Jewish community in Uzbekistan. You have ancient Christian communities. From Nestorian Christians, others, and of course in the modern era, Orthodox, Russian, Ukrainians, and so on form a distinct minority, as well as various other groups. So as I say, a great mixing group over literally millennia in Central Asia. Again, setting the stage, the population roughly is about 76 million. For all of Central Asia. Uzbekistan, which is considered sort of the heart of Central Asia, that's the green one, is by far the largest at 34 million. Kazakhstan, the second at 19. Tajikistan, something over 9 million. Kyrgyzstan at 6 million. And Turkmenistan, they claim, is about 5 or 6 million. But many observers believe it's actually maybe about two or three, because one, what's typical of Turkmenistan is virtually none of the data is reliable. They don't participate in many surveys of international organizations and so on. So who knows? But officially, they say it's about 6 million. Size, you can tell how Kazakhstan in yellow dominates the area. It's the ninth largest in territory country of the world. It's about the size of Western Europe. Turkmenistan is second in size. That's the sort of gold-colored one. It is about the size of Texas. Uzbekistan there in the center in green, as I mentioned, about the size of California. Kyrgyzstan about the size of Iowa. Tajikistan about the size of South Dakota. Now, one of the things that I wanted to mention when I said that Uzbekistan was the heart of Central Asia, it also has the distinction of being one of the only two, what we call double landlocked countries in the world. That means, and all of Central Asia, all the five states are landlocked, i.e. they don't border on any oceans, although there are two inland seas you'll see there, the Caspian and the Azov. Double landlocked means you are surrounded as well by also landlocked states. The other, by the way, is that I usually try and make people guess that, but I won't. It's Liechtenstein, by the way. Maybe this will come up on Jeopardy some night, and you will know the answer. Uzbekistan and Liechtenstein. But that's not just sort of a curiosity, because being landlocked in today's world is economically quite a disincentive, because you don't have any of the commercial and human trade and transportation links that are really vital in today's world. And also aviation rail links and so on had been quite disrupted at the end of the Soviet Union. So they've had quite a few strikes against them. But many people who know Central Asia may not have focused on it much in the modern days, but generally people have all heard that really sort of wonderful phrase, the Silk Road, which was basically the transit routes between Europe and China that existed for many, many years. And there was not one single road, but it was a series of caravan routes that went through the area. But, you know, with the rise of maritime aviation and other other issues, they really fell into disuse. In its heyday, I'd say between the 8th and the 12th centuries, medieval Central Asia was really one of the wonders of the world. Intellectually, in terms of its art, its trade, was phenomenal. I mean, these cities rivaled the great centers of their day, such as Baghdad and Damascus, at a time when London, for example, was just a small village. But Genghis Khan, I'm sure you've heard of, swept through in the early 13th century and really did quite a job on many of these great cities who really never, some of them never really recovered. Others took quite a long time. But let me skip forward to the Soviet period. The Russian Empire, the Russian period, the Russian Empire had started coming through really in the 18th century, primarily through the northern part of Kazakhstan, establishing forts and so on, and then gradually started moving south. Turkmenistan was the last to be brought into the Russian Empire in after a battle in 1881, and it's still celebrated as a day of national mourning in Turkmenistan today. And as a matter of fact, the president slash dictator of Turkmenistan would always assemble the diplomatic corps, i.e. all the ambassadors, for a ceremony on that day. And the Russian ambassador usually found a reason to be sick and not attend. But let's skip forward to the Bolshevik period and the legacy that 70 years of Soviet rule left in the area. And in a way, they were sort of both the breaker and maker of the area. Breaker in the sense that they disrupted and destroyed many ways the family customs, religion, language, history in a really devastating way. They collectivized and forced nomadic herding families, which was typical of the great steppe land of Kazakhstan, made them and slaughtered all the livestock. So there was massive starvation in the 20s. Then, like under Stalin, like so much of the Soviet Union, terrible purges. The gulags, there was a whole network of these gulags, the sort of concentration camps of the Stalinist period in actually Kazakhstan. Then in the First World War, they started conscripting the Muslim citizens who revolted, and there were actually serious outbreaks over that issue. This is before the Soviets, of course, but those were some of the real stirrings of unrest in the area. And then after the Soviets conquered, there still were pockets of resistance throughout Central Asia. And I think so the last of these rebels weren't finally put down until the 30s in mountainous Tajikistan. Okay, but so it was a mixed legacy. I mean, the Soviet Union did bring on the positive side medical care, education, state structures, industry. So a lot of positives. On the other side of the ledger, against this really negative legacy of destroying these indigenous cultures. But so let's skip forward to 1991, when basically the Soviet Union collapsed. And these five states were not pressing for independence, although there had been stirrings of nationalist sentiment over various issues. So when independence came, it was more thrust on them, and they were certainly not prepared for it. But nevertheless, they seized it. Largely, the previous communist leaders retooled themselves, as did the communist parties, to become the ruling elites. But they started off independence with very weak institutions, both political, legal, economic, and huge disruption in the economies. We were talking about it before, about all of their previous links developed under Russian and Soviet times, basically were all oriented towards Russia. You know the old phrase, all roads lead to Rome. Well, figuratively, in the old days, all roads led to Moscow. But Moscow was no longer the imperial center. So in a way, they really had to reinvent themselves. And this is where the US comes in, because we were involved from the very beginning. And we were generally the first outside country to have recognized their independence. We set up embassies in all of these countries, by the way, and we did it out of current resources, which was a huge economic hit from which it took many, many years to recover. But we set up full-scale embassies, although oftentimes we were working out of hotels and so on until we had new facilities built. So we recognized them. We immediately put in embassies to work with their governments. And we had, I'd say, roughly five different policy goals. First of all was just the general aim of recognizing and supporting their independence, their territorial integrity, and their sovereignty. These may seem like pretty basic concepts, but there was real concern that these fledgling states would fail, would be reabsorbed into the old Soviet Empire. So we also wanted to help integrate them into new regional and international institutions. So the United Nations, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, international financial institutions on a security basis. NATO formed something called the Partnership for Peace. So there was it was sort of just a cooperative relationship with all of these states. We didn't try to dissuade them from joining other groups. We simply wanted to give them other opportunities and help them find their own way in the world. We didn't see it as a zero-sum competition with Russia, but unfortunately, the Russians always did, because they continued to think of this area as their backyard, what they called their near abroad, their sphere of influence. So always a bit of a, you know, the US and Russia were always sort of watching each other fairly warily. We wanted to help them develop free markets, the rule of law, human rights. And this was a particularly rocky element of our relationship because, of course, none of these societies came out of historical democracies. There was no Renaissance, Reformation, any of the periods that gave us the basis for our own institutions. So that was always a, you know, an area between us because, as I say, many of these areas, these new leaders were the former communist leaders. But we thought it was important to push these issues of rule of law, not just because it's our own values, but there's a real dollars and cents value to it. When I said that, our diplomacy is focused on supporting American jobs at home by selling goods and services abroad, it's hard to do that in countries that are very corrupt because there's no level playing field. They will sell to whomever gives them a bribe rather than buying the best goods and services, which I'm happy to say, as a proud American, are very often American. Okay, two other goals I want to focus on, and that is energy. Kazakhstan has very, very substantial oil fields, and American industry was in there off the bat. Chevron invested very heavily in a major new oil field in Kazakhstan, which to this day I think is Chevron's biggest asset worldwide. ExxonMobil came in later and partnered with them. American firms provided all sorts of expertise in oil services and so on. And our basic policy was, in terms of international energy, it was considered a strategic and not just a commercial issue. Our policy was, we believe that we should enhance and diversify energy resources worldwide. Because again, look what we've seen in Ukraine and Russia, where Russia established a dominant role in supplying gas, for example, to Germany, which then gives them, in some ways, real leverage. So we've always believed we wanted to, as I say, enhance and diversify energy sources worldwide to prevent countries, in effect, using their energy to blackmail or establish dominance over their customers. So Kazakhstan presented real opportunities. We got in there early and helped them develop new fields and ship it outside. We built the first private pipeline in the former Soviet territory to get them their oil to export markets. Our other big energy target was Turkmenistan, which has the fourth largest natural gas reserves in the world. But the problem has always been, how do you get natural gas to market? Unlike oil, which you can put in tankers, in trucks, in rail cars, it's easy to move around. There's a world market for it. But gas requires infrastructure. You've got to pressurize it, pipe it through pipelines. So you can't just sort of ad hoc sell the stuff. And so we very much wanted to help Turkmenistan send its gas west across the Caspian Sea to feed into pipelines that would go to Europe. But there was a long-standing issue about how we delimit the Caspian Sea, that sea. Russia and Iran were not eager to see the other states establish their own export routes. So that issue tied them up for years. They came to a legal resolution not so long ago, but I think behind the scenes, Russia continues to exert enormous pressure on Turkmenistan not to make deals to send the gas west, because our system is one that was difficult for these formerly communist states to understand, and that is, we're a free market country. Governments don't build pipelines, our companies do. And he kept having this notion that we could simply build a pipeline for him. And we said, no, you have to create the conditions that will attract multinational investors. But as I say, a big problem was the fact that Russia was, I think, probably sending signals that we've got our eye on you, and watch out. So what changed later, and I'm skipping ahead a little bit, is that over time, the Chinese came in, who do have a different system, and the government will build the pipelines and will provide the financing. missing. So Turkmenistan is now sending the bulk of its natural gas east to China. Okay, so those were the top four I've just gone through. Let me get to another one, the last one that I'm going to focus on, that was at the top of our agenda from the beginning, and this is one that George and Karen Look know very well, and that is weapons of mass destruction. As you may have read, at the time that Kazakhstan was established as a modern nation, it became the inheritor of the fourth largest nuclear arsenal in the world. U.S., Russia, Ukraine third, and then Kazakhstan. So it inherited 1,400 nuclear warheads, about 1,000 international ballistic missiles, 40 heavy bombers, a cache of highly enriched uranium, which, as you know, is the stuff that you make bombs with. So this was top of our agenda. How do we transfer these weapons safely back to the country that actually did own them, and that is Russia as the successor to the USSR. We wanted to get Kazakhstan as a new state and, again, possessing this nuclear arsenal to sign on to START II, and also to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear state. The only way actually you can join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is as a non-nuclear state. So after some to-ing and fro-ing, we did accomplish this over a few years. And although the Soviet arsenal was repatriated to Russia, and it, by the way, it never actually was in Kazakhstan in control. It was on their territory, but all of this arsenal was actually in the hands of, I guess, the Soviet or the Russian strategic, command, and who guarded them, who maintained them, who had all of the nuclear codes. But still, if we hadn't arranged this, it could have been a big problem. So this was repatriated to actually the owners, the creators of this nuclear arsenal. But the Kazakhstan also had a cache of, and George will remember exactly how many tons we had of this highly enriched uranium. This we actually moved directly from Kazakhstan to the United States. And when we look at all this nuclear fissile material that came out of the former Soviet arsenal for I don't know how many years, 10% of U.S. electricity was generated by the fissile material that came out of the former Soviet Union. And there were other issues involving weapons of mass destruction in Central Asia. There was a particularly nasty biological weapons facility in Uzbekistan, other ones, and I won't go into it more here, but I think you can ask George and Karen about that, who I'm sure will have been George certainly and Karen is as well. So far, I haven't heard, for example, the Russians say, aha, how about those bioweapons labs there in Kazakhstan? You've probably heard about the way they are spreading massive disinformation about biological research labs in Ukraine, just as they did in Georgia. This is a very old disinformation story. So I mention this because who knows? Maybe someday we'll start hearing about these bioweapons labs that we've financed in Kazakhstan. But by and large, this dealing with these inherited weapons of mass destruction materials, again, including nuclear, biological, and chemical in Central Asia and the other republics was a huge success story for U.S. diplomacy. And it was a bipartisan program. You may have heard about the Nunn-Lugar program. So it was the Democrats and the Republicans working together to safely secure a lot of extremely dangerous material. Because again, the Soviet Union had fallen apart. They weren't paying necessarily guards, had the appropriate security. So there was a lot of concern that these materials could be sold on the international black market to terrorists. So this was a highly, highly successful program. We also, for example, helped seal the nuclear testing site where the Soviets and Soviets did the majority of their nuclear tests, a huge percentage of which were above ground and left a hideous environmental legacy. As a matter of fact, there's a new book published called Atomic Step that's a really good account of this terrible Soviet legacy and how the Kazakhs focused their energy before independence on combating this, and then the role we played in helping to remediate and seal up this nuclear test facility in Kazakhstan. So anyhow, these were the broad lines of our policy from 1991 forward. And then I'm going to skip forward to 2001 when there was, of course, 9/11. With those terrible attacks emanating from Afghanistan. At that time, by the way, I was in Washington because I had been nominated, but as you may have seen or heard, and it's something I'm very passionate about, it's gotten extremely difficult to get any of our ambassadors or senior officials confirmed. Not because there's questions about their character, their experience, or even relevant policy issues, but for completely unrelated issues. Senior officials have become political hostages in the Senate. So the reason I mention that is because in 2001, I had just been starting to prepare for my upcoming consultations and hearings. And Turkmenistan was not at the top of anybody's list, believe me. But after 9/11, because it was a frontline state, we had a Republican administration, of course, George W. Bush, the Senate, which confirms, has the duty to give advice and consent and confirm nominees, was in the hands at that point of the Democrats. Tom Daschle was the Senate Majority Leader. After 9/11, he called the president and said, "What can we do to help?" So they worked out a list of ambassadors and other folks that they felt were crucial to the Afghan crisis and moved them to the head of the line. I got a call from our Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations saying, "Hi, can you be ready in 2 hours and we'll ride up to Capitol Hill and have your hearings?" This normally takes a couple months to arrange, and I said, "Well, sure." So I wrote out my statement, not on a cocktail napkin, but pretty close to it, had my hearing along with the other ones that they had deemed were vital to get out to their posts. I was confirmed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the full Senate in 24 hours. We now have cases where officials are waiting a year. And because of the Ukraine crisis, with all of the new priorities that we have to deal with, it's become particularly damaging that, for example, I'm taking a little detour from Central Asia, but to me it all ties up broadly. We had holds, and that means you can't go further with the hearings, the votes, and any senator can put them on for any reasons they want. So we had one senator who continued holds on, for example, our assistant secretary who deals with refugees. We have 4 million and counting refugees in Ukraine. We have all the refugee issues with Afghanistan. We have a world today that is facing an unprecedented number of refugees and internally displaced people. And they couldn't confirm the assistant secretary who deals with refugees for no reasons associated with these issues whatsoever. It actually had to do with the Pan American Health Organization. No connection whatsoever. Our new special representative for sanctions policy at the State Department, same thing. Couldn't get confirmed. Now, we all know how important the sanctions are in our policy dealing with the Ukraine crisis. Couldn't get confirmed. Our representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency. I'm sure you saw the reports about how the Russians seized Chernobyl, where we had that terrible nuclear accident. They fired on the complex of the largest nuclear reactor in Europe, the Zaporizhzhia one. So the International Atomic Energy Agency is central to trying to deal with these issues. Our ambassador there is our liaison with them and the international community. Couldn't get confirmed. I just pick out three. And so they were appealing to this senator and saying, this is a crisis. These people are vital because of Ukraine, Russia, and so on. Anyhow, long story short is they literally just got confirmed this past week. But we should not have to do this. So anyhow, that's what I'm saying. I get a little passionate about this stuff, so bear with me. And so it doesn't have to be like this. And I'm, as I say, example A. Nominated by a Republican president, confirmed by a Democratic-controlled Senate that said to the Republican president, what can we do in the interests of American leadership at this time of crisis? So I hope, frankly, that one day we'll get back to what should be bipartisan support for our diplomacy. Okay, but back to Central Asia. These were frontline states. Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, directly border on Afghanistan, and these others, of course, are part of the issue. So, for example, we were able to establish support bases in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, although it was a formally neutral state whose neutral status had been registered with the UN, allowed us to establish a fueling facility for our military. So they were a huge help to us. Over time, of course, the need lessened. Then when, of course, we disengaged, over time, we were seen as being just that disengaged. And I realize I've gone way over. So this was sort of, where our sort of engagement in Afghanistan started to decline. China, I already mentioned in terms of energy, came way in. It announced its Belt and Road massive investment schemes in Kazakhstan in 2013. So, Russia and China are again the big players. And we're engaged, but very definitely way down the scale. But I would submit that with Ukraine, we need to be more engaged because they're gonna be watching what happens in Ukraine. And if Ukraine is reabsorbed, they will figure they're next. I also believe that we need to refocus on how we can help them get their energy to market and continue our efforts to reform these new states. So sorry to go on so long. That was more than 35 minutes.
Thank you, Laura. I know that we have a lot of speakers and we ask them to cover a huge amount of information in a short period of time, so we appreciate it. your ability to do that. While we collect questions from the audience, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question myself. You talked a little bit, or quite a bit, about oil and gas resources in this part of the world. But of course, we're trying to get rid of the dependence on oil and gas. Are there other resources that these countries have, or is oil and gas the only things they have?
That's a great question, and one that I've actually was just researching, because we noticed when we came to Maine, your solar panels. And obviously renewables is going to be hugely important as we try to transition away from dirty sources of energy. What I hadn't focused on before was that you need, you know, the so-called rare earth minerals to make these solar panels effective. And I am not an engineer, so I don't really know the details. So China has about, I'd say probably 90% of the world's production, putting it again in a very dominant position, because we need these rare earth minerals for a whole host of extremely vital purposes. So Central Asia does have rare earth minerals. Most of them haven't all been explored, but maybe as much as 10% of the world's total. And this is where America can come in, because we still have the best technology for identifying, mining, producing. So this is something that I hope we give a fresh look at Central Asia, because of the increasing importance of rare earth minerals. But again, harking back to one of our other goals, which is to promote rule of law, human rights, and so on, American companies are not going to want to go in and invest a lot of money if they think it's an extremely corrupt landscape, which sadly all of these countries do suffer from. But again, they do have that other energy resource there that I think we can play an important commercial and strategic role in.
Thank you. You didn't talk very much, I think, about the corruption or whether these states are on their road to democracy or that. Could you make a few comments on
That's been a pretty rough road. I have a list of resources that I couldn't find on my computer. My sheet is all scribbled on. But there's some really good resources that give metrics on corruption. The World Bank, an NGO called Transparency International, The Economist, the UN, all have, they rate and assess corruption around the world. Sad to say, if you check, you will find they rank near the bottom. So this is something that's been a really rocky road. It has improved in some cases. Uzbekistan, by the way, has been a real success story in recent years when the first president died in 2016. Because I say there's not been one single election that would be deemed free and fair in the area. So when the first president of Uzbekistan died, the new man came in and actually has instituted some reforms. They really want to open up. They're extremely interested in attracting American business. So they have been cleaning up their act, literally. Again, a long way to go, but you know, I always take success and forward movement wherever I can get it. So that's, as I say, been a bright spot in Central Asia.
Several questions here related to the relationships between these five countries and their surrounding countries. The one I think is the most general is, can you comment on the current state of relations among the Central Asian states? Cooperation, rivalry, are there ethnic and religious problems, or are those all smoothed over?
Great question. And here I went on for so long, and I really didn't even get to that extremely central issue. So whoever came up with that question, thank you. We talk about Central Asia. We talk about the five stands. They actually are, you know, distinct. So you really need to look at all five of them. And they also have both historic and modern sources of dissension among them. So that has been, was one of our original policies. How do we help these countries develop patterns of regional cooperation for environmental reasons? So for example, they can deal with severe environmental problems, water very much so, because it's a real deficit there. Climate change, security issues, trade, whole host of issues. And that has been a tough slog. But again, Uzbekistan, when I mentioned, was sort of the heart of Central Asia. It's the one that borders all of the others, the only one that does. It was particularly problematic in this area because it in many ways tried to seal off its borders. It had quarrels, and very serious quarrels, with all of its neighbors. So this was right in the center of Central Asia, a big impediment to regional cooperation. But the new man who came in made good neighbor policy literally the top of his agenda, and has transcended, not solved, but really jumped ahead. So the picture in that regard looks much, much better. But again, corruption is an issue, because we've been talking earlier about the problems of trade across borders. It's quite slow in this area because they now have lots of border regulations and so on, which impede the flow of goods. And part of the reason is because the officials are taking bribes and cuts. So you really, all of this stuff ties in, and that's why, as I say, getting at corruption is a central issue, I think, around the at home and around the world. As I say, I think things are moving in a better direction. Whereas we actually had cases where Uzbekistan was threatening to go to war with Tajikistan, which is an upstream state. So the great rivers of Central Asia originate in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And so Tajikistan wanted to build a new dam to generate electricity because they don't have any oil or gas at home. And so Uzbekistan said, you do that, because it would mean cutting off water that comes to them that they need for agriculture. We're going to go to war. It never quite got to the war, but anyhow, the old guy died, and the new guy, as I say, they've solved this. So, unfortunately, personalities do matter. And by the way, I'll just say, that was also one of our goals, was to try and promote effective and fair water sharing within this great water deficit region.
Thank you. Yes. As you might imagine, we have quite a few questions asking very similar questions. And that is, are the stands next when it comes to Russian invasions?
If Ukraine goes, I would say, I mean, my bet would be Moldova would be next. It's right next to Ukraine. The Russians already control the eastern part of it. It's the most vulnerable. But Kazakhstan would, I think, absolutely be in the Kremlin's sights. Because again, all of that oil and gas that they want to control. And when I said Central Asia, in Russian and Soviet terminology, they always said Kazakhstan and Central Asia. Because Kazakhstan had, the Russian Empire had started to move into Kazakhstan in, as early as the 17th century. Putin himself has said, we don't consider Kazakhstan a real modern state. Same as what he said, for different reasons, as he said with Ukraine. Made references like this several times. Extremist Russian politicians have said Kazakhstan, at least northern Kazakhstan, should be ours, because this was where most of the Russian settlers, starting from the 17th century, started to settle. This was where, during Stalinist purges, they dumped a lot of their prisoners from Russia, from Ukraine, and other places. They moved them away from the front. They dumped them in Kazakhstan, and many of these people stayed. So That, by the way, is one of the reasons I believe that the president of Kazakhstan, modern Kazakhstan, moved the capital from the south, which is Almaty, all the way to the north, to what's now known by his first name, Nur-Sultan, I think precisely because he wanted to anchor the capital in the traditional Slavic heartland. Because even way back then, they had suspicions of, a resurgent, recidivist Russian Empire. At the same time, when they navigate Ukraine policy, that's what they do. They have to straddle, because they may be extremely fearful and resentful of Russian aggression, but they know that Russia has significant leverage over them. I didn't mention the fact that particularly the poorer states of Central Asia, which is Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, have the highest levels of dependence on migrant remittances in the world, because they, the unemployed, which there are many, go to Russia to work, send money home to their families. So it's been estimated it's up to 50% for Tajikistan, about 30% for Kyrgyzstan, and even quite economically dynamic Uzbekistan, maybe 12%. So Russia's got levers on them. One other thing I'd say is that they're still very authoritarian societies. So they didn't like what they saw in Georgia, in the Georgian Revolution, in the original Orange Revolution. Revolutions scare them. They're authoritarians. They want to, you know, they want regime stability. And they also prize stability in general. So it was sort of a mixed message to them in the second Ukraine revolution of dignity when, you know, Yanukovych ran off. So they've tried to straddle it very carefully, but they have absolutely real concerns there.
So there were a lot of questions on Russia's design on the stands. There are a couple of outliers here, too, who want to know, is there any evidence that China is considering absorbing one or more of these Central Asian countries? What is their attitude toward these countries?
Well, I think that China's, at least for now, policy is not one of territorial or military control. But I mentioned that they unveiled this massive investment scheme called the Belt and Road Initiative in Kazakhstan in 2013. They have poured massive money into infrastructure around the world, which one, supports Chinese commerce around the world. It's also sort of an investment in security. Who knows if they might one day seize that port? So it's a concern, but these are poor nations, particularly the ones in the east, so Chinese investment is attractive. At the same time, China is not popular. They're taking the money, but there's a great, great deal of fear and mistrust of China. And by the way, keep your eye on this. There is a Chinese, it's called an outpost in Tajikistan, which is, of course, you know, one of the ones that border on China. I mean, so who knows if this might not grow over time. But the Chinese also have a strong interest in Central Asia, aside from the commercial one. I mentioned earlier the Uyghur populations. They have always been very concerned about cross-border support of this minority. They're afraid that Central Asian militants or Islamists from Afghanistan and the area would link up and foment unrest in Xinjiang. And of course, we've seen what they've done at home to repress those minorities. But such is the power of Chinese money that the Central Asian states, whose co-ethnic, their kinsmen in China, who have been put in concentration camps, their cultural rights and others despoiled by China, they have not been willing to openly criticize them. But on a political, a public level, it's certainly very much resented.
Let me follow up a little bit on all of this. If there are fears they'll be invaded, what's the status of their militaries? Are they strong? Can they be another Ukraine?
No, no, sadly. For example, Tajikistan, even when it became independent, continued to allow a Russian military base, the 201st Division, which actually was sort of the largest Russian base outside of Russia for many years. One, because they're concerned about an extremely porous border with Afghanistan. A lot of drug smuggling through there, heroin. Russia, by the way, is the largest consumer of heroin in the world today. And a lot of this heroin comes through. So part of it is to try and control the narcotics. But also, they were there because there had been a terrible civil war at the outset of Tajikistan's independence from 92 to 97. And so the Russians were sort of involved in that. There's a Russian military outpost because the Tajiks cannot control their own borders. The Kazakhstan has invested money and so on, but it's still nothing like on the order of Ukraine. Uzbekistan has a respectable army, but the trouble is that these armies are dependent on Russia. They still send most of their officers to Russian military academies. They get a lot of arms from there. They still have those post-Soviet ties. And we have, by the way, invited Central Asians to our academies. We've given them training. Haven't sold a lot of arms because of human rights and other issues. And also, countries like Turkmenistan are positively neutral, so they don't want to get too much in bed with us. So the short answer is, no, they do not have effective armies. And one last point. When national demonstrations broke out in Kazakhstan on January the 6th, they felt such a lack of confidence, clearly in their own security services. For the first time ever, they called on forces from what's called the Collective Security Treaty Organization, a post-Soviet regional organization to which some of them belong, to send in troops to restore order. They actually did not engage. They came in, they spent 2 weeks there, they sort of stayed back. But still, it was a sign that they're still dependent on Russia.
Well, we have some very good questions, but I think we're out of time. So I want to thank Laura for her presentation.
Okay. Thank you again for putting up with me. I mean, to go on about this interesting area, and I hope more of you do find the time to visit it. I mean, these are really phenomenal civilizations, the Silk Road tour, and they genuinely like Americans. You'll get an extraordinarily warm welcome, as warm as I did here in Maine. So I hope you do go, and I'm delighted that you've got some upcoming speakers, real experts on Afghanistan, so ask them how they think the Central Asians are faring with the Taliban.
One last thing, we can't let you leave without giving you one of the much coveted Mid-Coast Forum mugs for your morning coffee. And we actually have a new design. We ran out of the old one. So you're the first one of our speakers to get this particular design.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd love to come back. And I'm not going to...